Not Your Poppies podcast is a place where booze and humor are used to bring you the real raw stories of women throughout history.
It's feminism with a hint of tequila.
No es cafecito con tu abuela.
It's tequila shots with your best friend.
My name is Carmen.
And I'm Laura. And welcome to another episode.
How did you sleep last night?
I slept pretty comfortably.
Yeah?
Like, I literally, like, I think I was asleep before you even closed the door. Because I remember you telling me something about locking the door or something. And I was, like, already cuckooing up. And I was just like, I don't even remember you actually closing the bedroom door.
Locking the bedroom door?
Yeah, I think you said something like, oh, if you want to lock it or something. And, like, you hadn't even left the door. And I was already asleep. I was already like...
I'm such a weirdo. Like, where does my head go that I'm just like, and this is how you can lock your door for more privacy. I am such a person.
I think that's what you said, something like that. And I was just like, I was already checked out. Brandon's like, why'd you wake up so early? And I was like, I had a dream that I went downstairs for water. Like, in my dream, I went downstairs for water. And then I woke up and I was like, I'm so thirsty. And then I went down. But, like, I didn't want to go downstairs because I felt like going up and down the stairs was going to, like, take energy from me and it was going to, like, force me to wake up. So I just kind of, like, laid there trying to go back to sleep, but I was too thirsty.
Yeah. So you got up for water.
Yeah.
In the middle of the night.
After I dreamt that I got up for water. I hate when that happens in my dreams because then I, like, convince myself that I've already done it.
But you haven't.
But I haven't.
That's so weird. That's what happens when you drink. So don't drink, kids. You heard it from here first. Don't drink.
Yes.
You wake up like it's like a crazy thirst when you're like, because you're hanging, right? Like you're starting to build a hangover.
Yeah.
And I didn't think we were going to drink, honestly. I thought we were just, we were in a groove last night. Oh, so guys, by the way, Laura's in town and we're recording again. We are together again
in person.
Under the same roof in person. We're doing this again. She was able to be so gracious and come visit me all the way from El Paso. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
So last night when she came in, we were, she's like, how's your story? I was like, not done. And she's like, damn it, Carmen. I was like, yeah, so give me a moment while I get this done. And then we were just drinking tea and stuff. And then Brandon, being Brandon, was like, let me know when you guys want to drink.
We started off so classy.
So classy.
Because I got you the ginger and honey tea.
So good.
I discovered ginger and honey tea, like the Asian style, which is amazing. Wasn't it so good?
It was so good.
It is so good, you guys. If you get to go to an Asian grocery store, look for their ginger and honey tea. They have the one I actually have at my house. Yeah. It's like actual, like it's almost like honey with like pieces of ginger in it. But the one I got you was like the... like, it's like, what would you call it?
Like, it's like an instant tea, and like, it dissolves.
It's crystallized. There you go. It's crystallized. So we were sitting there, drinking our tea, working on our stories and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, like, two, like, cups of, like, gin and tonic appear. And then me and Carmen ever so casually started reaching for them.
We're like, just one. One's not going to do anything. And then Brandon was like, we have a special visitor. Let me show her my whiskey collection, my mezcal collection. I'm going to bring you the most expensive bottle I have so you can taste. So you're just like sipping on whiskey and
mezcal. Mezcal. We started doing mezcal.
Yeah. And then I was like, whoa. I was like, dang, Laura, you got the elite. Treatment at my house, which is fantastic, and you deserve no less.
That's what I expected. I even sent you a TikTok. I was like, if I don't get like luxury drinks, I'm gonna be so upset.
I mean, the morning is very young.
After I got you like drunk off of soju at my house, I'm like, no, I need luxury
drinks. The fact that soju was like a bottle, it's like the size of a beer bottle.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very large. And I drank. I was like, how's this going to do to me? It's not even going to.
A lot of people think that they're going to drink it like beer. Like they think they're going to get that experience. And then they're like shots. Halfway through the bottle and it like dawns on them that they're like wasted.
Yeah, I was very upset that that happened, it crept up on me. I think the sugary component of it is something that is so hard for me to just do. I would have felt okay if I would have just stuck with like the gin and tonics, but we ran out of tonic water. And then when you guys started doing like the little samples, I was like, ay, Dios, I already know. But it was great. We ended up cooking. We had a midnight snack. We made chilaquiles.
Carmen made us chilaquiles.
I made chilaquiles.
And I started eating them and then like dropped it all over my pants.
So, yeah, then we had to give you a change of clothes. That was fun. Well, thank you so much for making it all the way over here and visiting. It's always so much fun doing this, but, you know.
I think, like, one thing I like about us, like, drinking now is there's no, like, regrets the next day because we drink, we have fun, like, in our homes. We still have, like, our midnight chilaquiles, which is, like, something I missed from us going out, was always going back to your house for chilaquiles, like, after the club.
I don't know why it's my one dish that I make when I'm, like, drinking.
It's so good. I mean, like, you have your, you know, your tortillas with your spicy chili, mm-hmm. and then your cheese, and like what more can you ask for?
You can't ask for much in the world. I think that's what else can you ask for? Not much. But yeah, it was a wholesome night. We stayed up talking about just gifts, like gifts, like what you like and you have, like dones, right? Like how some people are very sensitive to, you know, the afterlife. Some people have like premonitions. Other people are very aware that this is their, I don't know, seventh cycle mm-hmm. in life. And those are always like fun conversations to have.
So. Or like when people could see your aura.
People can see your aura.
Your aura. How yeah. do you say it in English? Aura, right?
Your aura.
I said it right? Okay. Sometimes I don't know if I'm saying the word right in English because I'm so used to saying it only in Spanish.
Yeah. Yeah. That used yeah. to happen to me with the horoscope or signs. Like, I'd be like, Aries, and I'm like Aries, and I'm like, yeah.
For me, it was Pisces.
Pisces.
So I was like, Pisces. They're like Pisces.
Pisces.
And I was like, no, Pisces.
I'm thinking in Spanish and speaking in English, and then it's like when we went to Juarez that one time, that your cousin Fernando was like, yeah, if you guys go into Juarez, just don't speak English. And I was like, yeah, a word like that is common knowledge. And the reason you don't want to talk English is because you don't. You always get, like, hustled for extra money or they just treat you differently or, you know, not in a bad way. But it's just sometimes you just want to be a local, you know, you want to blend in. And Laura was like 10 minutes into being in Mexico and she's already speaking in English. I'm like, it's that way. Like,
I could have sworn because Carmen's like, stop speaking English. I was like, I could have sworn I was notice. Just talking Spanish to you.
Yeah, you had no idea. You were so unaware that you were speaking English, and I was like, that's so yeah. funny. But that's the bilingual mind. It's so
yeah,
it's another world.
I think I'm only like, because I was talking to you and I'm so used to going between the English and Spanish, mm-hmm. unless I'm like fully concentrated, mm-hmm. I will automatically switch and not notice. But I've noticed that when the person I'm speaking to, like, I'm very well aware that they don't speak English, I do like concentrate on making sure that I stay only Spanish. Because I don't want, to leave them, like, you know, like, lost in the conversation. Like, last night, I was doing the switching again, and then I would notice Brandon looked lost in what I was saying. So then I would switch back to English. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I forgot he can't, like, keep up with, like, my switching.
The switching. Yeah.
It's that bilingual brain, dude.
It is. Because our intentions are never to, like, you know, keep somebody out of a conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that happens to me often with Brandon. Brandon's like used to my switching already and he keeps up, bro. Like he understands so much Spanish, but he just can't speak it and he won't speak it. I can't even, he has no interest in learning Spanish, like speaking it.
Yeah.
He wants to just be able to kind of like follow the conversation and be like, oh yeah, 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 for sure. But he has no interest in learning Spanish, which I respect. Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to each their own. I love languages. I want to learn more.
Yeah. Well, it's also easy for us. Like, we already have an advantage where we speak two very common languages. But if you think about Spanish and English, most other languages are built off of that idea. So mm-hmm. we have a pretty good grasp.
Yeah.
Like, if we were, I think I'd be able to understand, like, Italian. I say this with no experience.
Having never actually been put on the spot to see if we understood it.
I listen to a lot of Italian, like, old school music, like, from the 60s. I don't know why. But, like, I'm like, oh, I can follow this. Like, I understand some of it. Yeah.
Well, but that's like me with Korean, right? Because I watch all my K-dramas.
See, I wouldn't be able to follow
Korean. So I swear I would be able to understand people if they spoke Korean to me. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, but then like I'll be on TikTok and I'll have it like, you know, like people speaking like, you know, like daily Korean with like the slangs and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, I have no idea what you're saying.
Yeah.
Where are the subtitles?
I would have no clue what they're saying.
Okay. Like totally changing gears over here. Did you hear about the 26-page report that the Secret Service just released talking about incels being, like, a growing terrorism threat in America?
What? Incels?
Incels.
What's that?
So incels is basically men who have labeled themselves as involuntary celibates. So for short, they call themselves incels.
Oh, my God. Okay, so they're voluntarily celibate.
Yes. Okay. So these are men who have, and mind you, that's what they labeled themselves, right? So basically, it's a heterosexual man who desperately wants to have sex with women but fails to do so. Consequently, heaping blame on women for their own inability to form sexual relationships. So basically, it's a 26-page report that was conducted by the National Threat Assessment Center, where they examined a lot of instances where men have been linked to the incel movements that have actually killed women. So like dozens of women in America and Canada have been killed because or attacked due to this movement in like the last couple of years.
So it's, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like it's a bunch of angry men that can't get anything to begin with, mm-hmm. right? And then say, well, I don't want it anyway. I choose this lifestyle because women are X, Y, and Z.
Well, no, they call themselves involuntary.
Involuntary.
Yes. Oh, so basically, It's involuntary celibate. So basically, they're blaming you for the fact that they have to be celibate. And probably, by you, I mean women.
Uh-huh. And mm-hmm. probably like feminists and like...
Oh, actually, yes. So basically, they characterize themselves as misogynistic extremist. So basically they also label themselves as anti-feminist. Mm-hmm. Because basically they say that they're unable to obtain romantic or sexual relationships with women, which they are entitled for. So they feel like we owe them that sex, we owe them that relationship, and it is our fault for being feminist that we don't give it to them. Like, mm-hmm. we're supposed to just give it to them. Mm-hmm. And like, it's weird because I saw a couple of articles or some on CNN. The one I'm reading off of right now is like on Independent, so it's like the UK newspaper. And so they were talking about like instances where, like, for example, there was this guy in Tallahassee, Florida, that went to a yoga studio and just started like shooting it up. So he ended up killing two of the women there, and he injured four other people. And basically, he was mad because these women doing yoga was like, how would I say it? Like, you know how like people say like, oh, well, what were you wearing? Like, you were inviting them. Mm-hmm. Like, he felt like these women doing yoga were like inviting him. Like, they were trying to tease him, but they just would never give up. So he was pissed off. You know what I mean? So he viewed yoga as like in a very sexual manner. It wasn't like these women going to just do their yoga and release stress. No, they went to do yoga because they were trying to tease him and then not put out. Mm. So he went and killed them.
Men are complicated.
No, they're not complicated. They're stupid. Like, you have to be stupid to think that anyone owes you anything. Like, I don't know. I was listening to this and I was like just shocked because I was like, oh my God, they actually have a word for themselves. And they actually have a whole movement. Because apparently, like, there's like networks on Reddit and Facebook and like pages where they get together and they'll talk about like, oh, like, you know, like my neighbor talked to me. So obviously it means she wants me, but she's not like, she's not giving me any advancements. Like, mm-hmm. like it's these guys. Have you ever like met a guy that you're just nice to them because that's just who you are? Mm-hmm. But then they start trying to flirt with you.
Yeah.
And you're like.
Many times.
Yeah. Like, and then I'm like, don't nice mistake my being nice person. For flirting. That's just who I am. This yeah. is how I talk. This is how I am. Like, I'm a very friendly person. It's like that type of mentality, but to the extreme. Like, you yeah. talk to me. You owe me sex.
Mis huevos. No. Chinga tu madre. Mm-hmm. Now I've had situations like that, and it's sadly it even ends like the friendship because mm-hmm. I have genuine connections with people regardless of their gender or what they identify as, and it's always the straight men that confuse it and they get it twisted, and I'm always like, what?
I think it's so sad when you realize that this friendship that you cherished ended up just being them waiting for the opportunity to get into your pants. So it was like never a real relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like you end up feeling like disheartened, and you also end up feeling like how would I say, like lied to. Because you're like, I trusted you. Like, I cared about you. Like, this friendship meant something to me. And this whole time you were just waiting for a chance to, like, you know, get my pants.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's why in like the last couple of years, I've like let a lot of like my friendships with men go, because I realized that they weren't, it wasn't like a two-sided friendship. Mm-mm. Like this whole time they were just expecting something from me mm-hmm. and it really hurt me.
You know, I don't get usually, I don't know. Let me see. So like, I don't have exactly like those situations. I have like acquaintances that do that are like extremely nice to me, like, well, they're interested in me, right? And I'm just myself, and then I see it, blah blah blah, and then I call it out. I don't even call it out, I just maintain my distance. But my actual relationships that mean something to me don't ever go that way. Like Chuck, right, for example, like he's a very straight, very attractive man.
Yeah.
And we've never seen each other like in that light, and we're extremely close. And I don't think at one point in our friendship have we ever been like, you know, like
interested
in like that in yeah. each other. And like that, I have multiple relationships where they're very, you know, they're genuine relationships. It's most with like the acquaintances, and so very early on, I can say, am I gonna milk that you like me? Maybe. Especially if it's at a workplace environment.
Yeah, like, am I going to take advantage? Because
it's not my fault you're interested in me. Let me get your input with this project. Yeah. You know, like, you have to use it to your advantage, right? And then it's good because you probably learn something, and you learn that you don't want that person in your life, and mm-hmm. you don't want to invest emotionally. So
to me, I feel like I was like rather naive because I always had like instances where I have had friends, right? I've had friends that last a long time mm-hmm. that, like you said, there was never an interest in me on them and them on me.
Right.
But then I've had a lot of friendships, or what I think are like, I'm forming a friendship, right? Mm-hmm. And then later on, I find out that like this whole time, this guy has like been waiting, you know, to like yeah. hook up with me, or to like blah, blah, blah. Or like, oh, I've liked you for so long. And I was like, what? I was like, I thought we were friends. Like, this whole time I've been talking to you about other girls I thought you liked.
It's wild.
And I'm like, you, like, deceived me. You lied to me. And it's, like, the opposite. You. They're expecting the sex from me, and I'm expecting the friendship from them.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think, but we've always talked about this. Your boundaries are, like, very hardcore. Like, yeah. these are my boundaries. Whereas me, I've always been a boundary pusher, as well as, like, sometimes I feel like I haven't set my boundaries as solid as I feel like I should have, which is like something I've been working on lately, is like okay. setting like real boundaries and not letting people push me past them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a never ending. It sucks because we're the ones that have to do the learning. We have to set the boundaries when the fucking, all we're asking for is the bare minimum
yeah.
from men. And we still have to set those boundaries. Yeah, no, I...
But very... I'd be lying if I would say I haven't taken advantage of the fact that, like, at work, once I found out, like, somebody had a crush on me or something, a guy especially, I would totally milk it. I'd be like, oh, my God, I need help with this and this and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And then you're running. Yeah. Then you run with the – on the flip side, it's so touchy because if you become successful in the workplace and you leveraged that situation, then you become the whore.
That is true.
And then people start making assumptions that you probably slept with them, that you did this with them, and that's why you got so far. Some of the most, if you think about it, in the workplace, some of the most successful women, people have made rumors, which are they true or not? I honestly don't
Who cares?
Look at their work ethic. Their insane hustle. Like, look at that. No, she got there because she did this and this and that, and he's married and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I remember Carmen and I were being mentored by, in our office, by, like, a colleague that was, like, you know, in leadership positions. And me and Carmen, like, really looked up to this lady. I mean, we still do. We really admired her work ethic. She was so driven. She was a hustle life. She was a single mother like us. Like, there was just so many things that we related to her on a level. And her talks were so real and raw. And then people started coming to us, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, did you know that she got that position because she slept with so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so? And I remember one time we talked to her about it, remember? And she said it. She's like, people are going to talk so much shit about you because they're not willing to say that you were successful because you put in the work and they're still in their same positions for 20 years because they never did. They don't want to say, like, my lack of drive is what kept me here. No, they'd rather say, oh, no, she got there because she slept with so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And it's at that moment that I realized that the whole office culture of, like, the whore only getting to leadership positions because of that, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
It's bullshit.
That's what I'm telling you, right? So it's walking very, very, it's treading lightly, honestly. Is it worth it? Is it worth the reputation milking a relationship? Is it worth having to emotionally burden yourself with somebody you think is a friend? It's always you're always going to lose something in this trajectory, right? That's why.
Well,
be socially awkward.
You know, I love the way this conversation is going because my lady did just that.
She
milked the relationships.
And she became successful doing so.
Yes.
What extremely a transition. Successful. We went from these baby men to the toxic workplace. And now we're introducing your story.
To women taking advantage of that. So, right. It's like this, like, never ending, like, toxicity loop. So basically, let me introduce you to my story.
And what a beautiful intro.
So I'm pretty sure the vast majority, like maybe like 90% of the world has heard of this lady. But not none of us, or at least the majority of us, don't really know her origins. Oh. So I bring you the story of Gabrielle Bonher Chasnell, otherwise known as Coco Chanel.
Coco Chanel.
Coco Chanel. So, Gabrielle, or Chanel, was born on the 19th of August of 1883 in Saumur, France, to Eugenie Jean Devol Chanel and Albert Chanel. So, her mom was Jean, her dad Albert. So she was actually born in a charity hospital, which is also known as a poorhouse hospice. Mm. So her family was extremely poor. Her mom worked as a laundry woman and her dad was like a street vendor. So the dad would find like secondhand clothes and stuff and kind of like fix them up and then like resell them. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really have like a set home. Because of her dad's job, they kind of like would travel a lot wherever he could really find work. And when it's funny, so her name, right? I said her last name is Chasnell, not Chanel. When she was born, her mom, Jean, she wasn't like really well enough to attend registrations. And her dad had been traveling because of work. So the people who actually submitted her birth certificate, they spelled her last name wrong.
Oh, and that's where we got Chanel?
No, that's where you get Chasnel.
Chasnel.
The actual last name is Chanel. Oh, that okay. is the last name. Her dad was Albert Chanel. But she was born, registered, and went to her death as Chasnel.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And there'll be a fun fact at the end as to why. Since they were poor, right? And they traveled a lot because of, like, the dad's line of work. They usually would live in, like, one-room dwellings.
Okay.
And so, mind you, it was the dad, the mom, and a total of 6 siblings. So it was 4 girls, 2 boys. So they had this little one-room dwelling in Brief La Gailarde. And Gabrielle was the 2nd oldest.
Hmm.
Right? So she had her oldest sister, Julia, and then she was the 2nd oldest. Now, when Chanel was 11, her mom died at the age of 32. And her dad, what he ended up doing was... he sent her 2 brothers to work on a farm, and then Chanel and her 3 sisters were sent to a convent in Abu Zain. You guys, these are all like towns in France or cities in France. I'm probably going to butcher their names.
Yeah, I don't know. You sound native to me. So.
Me and Carmen are always apologizing for butchering French. One day we're going to be like professional French speakers.
I'm not, but you do you, boo.
So basically, the convent was, it was created to care for the poor and the rejected, and it included renting homes for abandoned and orphaned girls. So once at this convent, right, it's like ran by like the Catholic Church, by nuns, and she gets brought up in like a very like strict and like very frugal manner, but she does learn to sew here, which is probably what... kind of inspired her like career choices convent, later on in life.
Learning to sew?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because she learned to sew at the convent. So she turns 18. She ends up having to leave the convent because it's only for like young girls. And she goes to a boarding house for Catholic girls in Moulins. Now, here's a fun fact. When Chanel would actually talk about her childhood and upbringing, she would say that after her mom had passed away, her dad had gone to America to seek fortune, and that she was raised by her 2 aunts. And she would also say that she was like born a whole decade later, and that she was only a toddler when her mom died. Like in her mind and the story she would tell, she was raised in a very, like, lavish upbringing and not so much in the reality of it, which was, like, that they were, like, dirt poor and that.
She was very, like, Teresa and Ruby.
Yes.
One of those 2 women would lie about, yeah, I think it was Ruby, who she would just, like, not say that that's her mom, that was her cleaner or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. The plot thickens. All right, yes. So she's embarrassed of being poor.
She is. She was extremely embarrassed of her, the way she grew up, right? And so once she was at the boarding house, right? So she moves over to the boarding house because she's over 18 now. And she ends up finding work as a seamstress during the day. And at night, what she would do is she would actually go to a cabaret to sing. And the cabaret was frequented by the cavalry officers. And what she did was she was actually like a passus, I think I'm saying this word right, which is basically the entertainment between the main acts. So she was kind of there to make sure like that the vibe didn't die in between the actual main singers. And this is actually where she started going by Coco, because she frequently sang the song "Who Has Seen Coco?" She would also say, so according to her, that's the reason she would call herself Coco, was because that was the nickname her dad had given her. But a lot of people, especially like people from her like actual like, you know, upbringing, they're like, no, that's not true. Like, my dad never called her Coco. And so Chanel, she had like a very like juvenile allure to her, like kind of like that, like very like young mindset, young girl, and she would use that to like tantalize the officers that would go to the cabaret and like use that to like, you know, get tips and stuff, talking about using your pretty privilege. And I mean, it, you know, if the officers are willing to pay and tip her for that, you know, more power to her. So basically she wants to make this her main career. And in 1906, she ends up going to Vichy, which was like a resort town where people would go and become like entertainers and singers. And she wants to like really do a singing career. And it's funny because so when Chanel was young, she had the physical charms and she would impress people, right? She was like very alluring, very like sexy, very tantalizing. And she auditioned to become a singer, but her singing was like very subpar. So instead of giving her a job as a singer, they ended up giving her the job as like the girl who takes like water and drinks to the people who are attending. Well,
that's like a fall from grace, like going to being an entertainer to be like, hey, here's a bottle of water, take it to homie. How did she take that?
So it's when she actually realized that, like, she didn't have a future as a singer or performer. It was, like, after this that she's like, this isn't going anywhere. And this is where she ends up going back to Moulins, right? Because, like, she's like, my singing career is over, which, like, it was, like, non-existent and never really started, but it was over. And at the age of 23, she ends up meeting Etienne Balzan, who was a young ex-cavalry officer and a textile heir. She becomes his mistress, and for the next 3 years, she lives with him at his Chateau Royal-Lieu near Compiège. We should have someone who's, like, French and, like, can walk us through this and teach me how to actually say it. Because, okay, so Balzan's wealth and his social status allowed Chanel to live a life of, like, socializing and partying and decadence, and he would give her diamonds, dresses, pearls. And it is said that Andrew Palazzi, who went as Chanel's sister Julia's son, was actually Chanel and Balzan's son. But that her sister Julia raised him as her own. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So it is rumored that she did have that one son, but there's like no facts because he was registered as like Julia's son.
She gave him away to the sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in 1908, she begins another affair with Balzan's friend, Captain Arthur Edward Capel.
But why affairs?
You'll see.
Okay.
So she had this thing about affairs and like using her romantic liaisons. So Capel was also extremely wealthy and he was a member of the English upper class. And he ended up buying her an apartment in Paris and he gave her the money for her first shops. So he funded her vision of becoming a fashion designer.
Okay, so... Okay, that's smart. I like that.
Right? I'm telling you, she knew how to use it. She knew how to use her charms. She knew how to use her pretty privilege. And I think the reason why these were all affairs and not marriages is because she realized that being married to someone means you're tied to them, to their goals, to their dreams. And you have to be like the housewife, right? Which like back then is what was expected of you. Whereas where you were just the mistress, you got the vacations, you got the money without the responsibilities of having to maintain a home for them.
Yeah. You got all the perks.
Exactly.
Relationship without the
hustle. Now, it is said that Capel actually inspired the design of Chanel No. 5.
The perfume?
Like, the bottle.
The bottle?
Yeah, that he inspired it. And like I said, he would take her on lavish vacations, and during this time, Capel and Balzan were friends. She has an affair with both of them going on, and so they're basically, like, competing for her. So they would both finance her lifestyle, her career aspirations. And during this time is when Chanel actually began designing hats. And she opened a boutique, which she named Chanel Molds, at 21 Rue Cambon in Paris. And this is really where her career as a designer started taking off, because there was an actress by the name of Gabrielle Dorziat who wore her hat in the play that she was in, which was Bel Ami in 1912. And after that, she actually started modeling Chanel's hats for her. And in 1913, Capel, so the second man she had an affair with, gives her the money to open up a boutique in Diaouville, where she started designing and selling deluxe casual clothing. In 1915, she opens up another boutique in Biarritz. With the success of the boutique in Biarritz, she was actually able to repay Capel for his original investments. So she did pay him back for like what he financed in her fashion career. Not everything else. Like the apartment, the jewels, and all of that were obviously gifts, but his original investment in her business, she pays it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good.
So in Biarritz, so this is what, her third boutique. So after she opens her third boutique, she really, really takes off, right? This is where she starts getting her own money. And in Biarritz is where Chanel meets Grand Duke Dmitri Pavlovich Pavlovich of Russia, which she also had a brief romantic liaison with, and they like continue to be friends afterwards. She continues to be Capel's mistress even after he actually gets married, until his death on the 22nd of December in 1919. And she is quoted saying, 25 years after his death, right? She's quoted saying to her friend, Paul Morand, about Capel's death. His death was a terrible blow to me. In losing Capel, I lost everything. What followed was not a life of happiness, I have to say.
Well, at least she was happy being the other woman. Like, it was enough for her. Like, she got a lot of what she needed, and she probably genuinely loved him.
Yeah. I think based off of, like, the way she's only ever quoted about saying that about him, whereas her other, like, romantic affairs or liaisons, they would kind of end, and she would just, like, maintain a friendship with him afterwards. Like, I feel like to her it was more like a stepping stone, mm-hmm. whereas with him it was really, like, she really did love him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so mind you, during this time, so he passes away. It's 1919. She buys the building at 31 Rue Cambon in Paris. In 1921, she opens up another fashion boutique, which she later expanded to offer jewelry and fragrances. By 1927, she owned 5 of the buildings on Rue Cambon.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So she's like really expanding. And this is like an area that is like very popular at this time for like the fashion industry and shops and blah, blah, blah. She now owns 5 of those buildings. In the 1920s was when she started designing the dance costumes for the Ballet Russes, after allowing the composer Igor Stravinsky and his family to live in her Belle Respiro home in Paris. And so basically the Stravinsky family had fled the Soviet Union after the war, and she like, you know, gives them a place to live, and then she starts like designing the costumes for the ballet company that this man creates. In 1924, she makes an agreement with Pierre Werthermeer, where she allows him to sell Chanel number 5. So this is probably the one man I would say remember his name. So Pierre Werthermeer. She makes an agreement with him. She allows him to sell Chanel number 5 in his department stores. And later on, Pierre and his brother Paul and Théophile Bader create Parfums Chanel. So basically what Parfums Chanel did was that the company would fully finance the production, marketing, and distribution of Chanel No. 5. And Chanel licensed her name out to them for 10% of the stock and then decided to like withdraw any further involvement in the business operations.
Okay.
So she's basically like lending them their name, allowing them to like take full control of Chanel No. 5, right? And the way that worked is with the company, Pierre and Paul, the brothers, would receive 70% of the profits and Théophile would receive the remaining 30. But Chanel actually fought for the next 20 years
to get it back,
to gain full control of Parfums Chanel, and claimed that Pierre was the bandit who screwed her over.
Oh.
Yes. So she kind of said, like, this business deal was like, it was more for them than for me and blah, blah,
well,
blah.
Well, she probably saw the profits too. And she's like, how am I getting gypped out of my own name, like my own brand? It'd be something to definitely get back. I don't like the way Coco Chanel smells. Or Chanel No. 5, Coco Chanel.
You know what? I don't either. Every time I smell it, I feel like it's
It's an old lady smell.
Yes, it is an old lady smell. Do you remember that like super popular song by Las Horoscopos del Durango?
Which one?
Te tinte el labio, toque de rimel, antes muerta que sencilla.
Okay.
And then she says about like putting on Chanel No. 5. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is such a, that's a perfume that like people who have not smelt better perfumes will buy because it thinks it's going to make them smell rich. But in the reality, you just smell like an old lady.
But you know what's interesting is that it's one of those perfumes too, that it varies by body, because if I smell the perfume by itself, mm-hmm. it's grotesque to me. But when my mom, because my mom's been wearing No. 5 all my life, and my mom makes it smell like beautiful.
Yeah.
And then I wear it and I'm like, ugh, gross. Like,
yeah. Because you're like, you're sweating your hormones with a perfume. Like, they're going to make every single perfume smell different. Like, yeah. Even if we wear the same perfume, it's not going to smell the same on me that it would on you.
Yeah.
So I guess it makes sense. I never even noticed that your mom wore Chanel No. 5.
Yeah. And she is very pungent. All her clothes, if you go into her closet, all her clothes smell like No. 5. She got a gift when she was like in her 20s and she's just been wearing it ever since. But anybody, well, I don't know. It's such a distinct smell that if I smell it, I recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, ugh, gross. You smell like an old lady. But it's funny because when my mom wears it, it smells so good. And then I try to smell, oh. It's weird. It's so, so
maybe
good.
It's us. Maybe we can pull it off.
Yeah, I like more
because your mom
tones.
Is definitely lives that lifestyle of antes muerta que sencilla.
My mom is so bougie, you guys. Yeah. So bougie.
Her hairstyles, her makeup.
She's so
cute. She's like,
I'm
turning necks. I'm breaking necks the minute I walk through that door.
I'm like nothing like that because she's so extra that I'm just like.
You try to be so like conspicuous and your mom's like, no, everybody's attention on me. I love that about your mom though.
And she loves it.
And she dominates the room
like,
she enters in.
Why do you have to overdo it? We're just going to go here, mother. She's like, I do it because it makes me feel beautiful. And I'm like, okay, I'm like in the leggings and tennis shoes. She's like, it's just not my fault that you're simple. She tells me that.
You're a simpleton, Carmen.
Yeah, she's like, you're so simple.
Okay, maybe that's why we don't like Chanel No. 5, because we're simpletons.
But I don't like anything brand.
So the brothers, right? They have full control of the company. They have full control of the distribution of Chanel No. 5. And so we're now, the little timeline, I'm kind of going back and forth because there was so much going on during this time, right? This is 1920s. This is when she meets them. This is when they take over Chanel No. 5. But now we're back in 1923. In 1923, Chanel was introduced to an elite group of the highest levels of British aristocracy.
Okay.
Do you see how I said that? Aristocracy.
Aristocracy.
Yeah. It's at this time that she starts associating herself with politicians such as like Winston Churchill, aristocrats like the Duke of Westminster, and even royals such as Edward, the Prince of Wales. Mm-hmm. Now, if you remember Edward, the Prince of Wales, he was like that guy that became king, and he was like king for less than a year because he decided to abdicate the throne to his brother because he wanted to marry somebody who was like a commoner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he would be the uncle of Queen Elizabeth.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's also, he had a, I saw the speech, is it the speech? Didn't he have like a, era tartamudo, también?
I'm not sure.
I don't know. Could be wrong. It could be
like a stutter?
Yes.
A stutter. I'm not sure. I didn't see that about him. They don't really like describe him too much, but during this time, right? She begins another affair with the Duke of Westminster. So at this point, we are up to four affairs. Okay. So the Duke of Westminster, Hugh Richard Arthur Grosvenor. I don't understand why all of these people have like four or five names to them. It's so hard. So Hugh, he would gift her also extravagant jewels, expensive art, and he buys her a home in Mayfair, which is a district in London known for being like extremely bougie and prestigious. Their affair lasted about 10 years. It's also rumored that during this time, Chanel also had a brief romance with the Prince of Wales. Yeah, because he apparently like liked her, and he like would make it known to her that he really liked her, and she low-key took advantage. Like, their fling was like really brief, like almost like maybe like a one-night stand, but she definitely knew he liked her, and she like used it for her, in her favor. Mm. Yeah. So now the Duke, right? So that's like the main affair during this time. The Duke was like a super outspoken anti-Semite? Is that how you say it? Anti-Semite? Yes.
What does that mean?
A person who like hates the Jewish people.
Anti-Semitic?
He was an anti-Semite. He was anti-Semitic, yes. Okay. But he was an anti-Semite.
English is not my first language.
And he actually... So Chanel, she already had like a dislike for the Jewish people. And he like fed that, it like he fed it more. Like,
and Chanel didn't like the Jews?
No, she didn't.
Right way.
Yeah, she didn't like the Jews. And he like started feeds more and more and more. Because they shared like this deep expressed dislike of Jews. And they were also extremely homophobic.
Were they?
Yes. So Chanel is actually quoted as saying, quote, "Homosexuals? I have seen young women ruined by these awful queers. Drugs, divorce, scandal. They will use any means to destroy a competitor and to wreak vengeance on a woman. The queers want to be women, but they are lousy women. They are charming, though."
Gross.
And I think it's so ironic. Like, her statement is so ironic because I'm like, I'm sorry, but don't you also use people like to get ahead in life?
Yeah.
Aren't you also scandalous because you're having all these affairs with these married men?
So she's not a good person, right? There's just so many things that you brought up that I'm like, where's the part where she's kind of like, she earned her success? I mean, she earned her success, but...
I mean, she was a good fashion designer. Nobody takes that away from her, but nobody knows the story of who she was as a person. She
sounds like a terrible person.
Dude, she was so, like, her statement is completely ironic. And the reason why I wanted to put this quote in here is because everything she judged the quote-unquote homosexuals, as she called them, for, she did. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? She broke up marriages. She had affairs. She was scandalous. She was a drug user. So Chanel's affair with the Duke inspires her to create the less is more aesthetic. So this is also where she starts being much more revealing with her clothing. You know what I mean? And this is also during the time that she actually starts designing for Hollywood. Well, by 1935, Chanel had become a habitual drug user. She would inject herself with morphine daily.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea.
And she actually continued to use morphine up until her death. And she died pretty old. So that's like years and years, decades
of drug use. Maybe that's the fountain of youth. No. Just kidding, you guys. Just kidding.
Please don't use morphine, Carmen. There's actually a rumor that Chanel was called Coco because she threw the most fabulous cocaine parties in Paris.
I see, that makes more sense now.
Right?
Than her dad singing a song to her.
It's not because your dad called you Coco. It's because you're a Coco head. So, again, Chanel was like known. She was known. Like, she did not hide it. She was known to be the mistress of some of the most influential men of her time. She even helped fund some of her lovers. Like, for example, designer Paul Iribe. He had this monthly newspaper called Le Témoin, which encouraged a fear of foreigners and preached anti-Semitism. So I'm telling you, she made it known. Like, she did not hide the fact that she did not like the Jewish people. So it's 1939. We're at the beginning of World War II. Chanel straight up closes all of her shops. Everything. Closes it all down and just dismisses, fires all 4,000 of her female employees.
Female employees?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She had all female employees, dismisses all 4,000 of them because she stated that it was not a time for fashion. Now, biographer Hal Vaughn suggests that Chanel actually used the war as an opportunity to retaliate against her workers who had asked for higher wages and shorter work hours and had actually participated in the French general labor strike of 1936. So this was like her way of getting back at them, but she was using the war as like
an excuse, as a cop out.
And it was after she closed her shops that she really solidified her hatred of Jewish people and the fact that she viewed them as a threat to Europe. During the war, she begins an affair with German aristocrat Baron Hans Gunther von Dinklage. She also takes refuge in Hotel Ritz, which was used as the headquarters of the German military in France. So at this point, she starts an affair with a German aristocrat, and she is like seeking refuge, right? Where all like the German top-notch military officers are in France. In May of 1941, Chanel took the opportunity during the Nazi seizures of all Jewish-owned property and businesses to gain full monetary fortune generated by perfumes Chanel. So she used the fact that as an Aryan, she petitioned German officials to legalize her claim to sole ownership, since the directors of perfumes Chanel, the Wertheimer brothers were Jewish. So she was trying to take advantage of the fact like that all the Jewish people were like losing their property and shops. And she's like, well, it's my chance as an Aryan. I have rights to this business. Now, unfortunately for Chanel, and fortunately for Pierre and Paul, the brothers, they had already anticipated like the forthcoming Nazi mandates against the Jews. And in May of 1940, they had legally turned control of Perfumes Chanel to Felix Amoit, who was a Christian French businessman. And after the war, Felix actually returned Perfumes Chanel to the brothers. So they already knew, like, they were anticipating they didn't want to lose their business. So they made, like, a really, really wise business decision. Now, even after the war, Chanel would continue to sue for the rights of Perfumes Chanel. And in 1947, the brothers agreed to give Chanel wartime profits of Chanel No. 5 in an amount equivalent to $21 million in today's money. And they also agreed to a future share of 2% of all Chanel No. 5 sales worldwide, which was projected to be about $25 million per year, making her one of the richest women of the time. And Pierre, the brother, the original one that she made the business contract with, he even agreed to pay all of Chanel's living expenses for the rest of her life. Wow. So at this point, I'm just like, he is a very savvy businessman because he realized the potential Chanel No. 5 has, buys the rights to it, to the distribution, to using Chanel's name, right? Mm-hmm. Sees that the war is coming, sees that me and my brother might potentially lose this business. So he gives the legal rights to a person he trusts. Mm-hmm. And even after all the bullshit Chanel pulls during World War II, even after that, he's still willing to, like, you know what? I'm still going to give you profits. It was your perfume to begin with. It is your name. I'll still give you the profits. But the bullshit Chanel pulls during World War II, if I had been Pierre, I would have, like, told Chanel to fuck off.
Yeah.
Like, fuck you. Because in 2014, French intelligence agencies declassified and released documents confirming Chanel's role as a Nazi spy.
Oh, shoot.
Mm-hmm. So not only did she hate the Jewish people, she actively participated in, like, the whole Nazi regime.
She was a Nazi herself.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So she was directly involved in a plan for the Third Reich to take control of Madrid. Chanel had visited Madrid in 1943 to convince the British ambassador to Spain about a possible German surrender once the war was leaning towards an Allied victory. And one of her most prominent missions was to be a messenger from Hitler's foreign intelligence to Winston Churchill.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And the shitty part is that when the women in France were being punished for their collaborations with German officers, Chanel fled to Switzerland with help from Winston Churchill to avoid criminal charges for her collaborations as a Nazi spy.
Isn't that crazy? I think I know I've done, like, two stories already where I also have spies during World War One or Two, but, like, they're good people.
Yeah, they were, like, spying for the correct person.
For the right reasons. And they were interesting and cool. And it sucks that.
And
the thing that, you know,
it's like during this time, Josephine Baker was being a spy, but in to France. Help.
Yeah, but to exactly. And
Chanel number five was, like, on the opposite end.
Chanel, what the hell?
Yes. So remember, she fled to Switzerland, so she avoids any criminal charges for her collaborations as a Nazi spy. And historians state that Churchill's deep involvement in assuring that Chanel was never prosecuted was because he didn't want her to expose the pro-Nazi sympathies and activities of top-level British officials, members of the social elite, and the royal family. Mm. Now, there has been long-standing rumors and confirmed facts that a lot of the royal family members were Nazi sympathizers, and some even actively participated. Maybe you should do a story on one of them. Expose all of these people, like the Nazi sympathizers, like just Queen expose Elizabeth? Them to the world.
Nah, she's too boring. Nah, she has a whole Netflix show.
She does, right? The Queen,
The Crown.
Which I've The Crown. There you go. I don't watch any of them. I think the British royal family is so boring.
It's supposed to be really good, but I think they are dirty. You don't really have to watch it to know what they did to Princess Diana.
And, yeah.
You know, even Meghan Markle, like what they're doing right now.
Like the only two actual people of their family that are, like, interesting and worth paying attention to, they did them so dirty, right? Princess Diana and Meghan Markle. Mm-hmm. Which I'm like, they're like the only two people who actually, like, are interesting.
Are interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And good people. Yeah. Okay, but this is not about the royals. This is about Chanel.
Okay.
So
Chanel should have her own show too. Netflix should make one.
Yes.
Could be good.
Dude, I'm pretty sure she's like turning over in her like tomb right now because we're exposing the fact that she was born dirt poor and that she was like a Nazi spy.
She probably doesn't care that she's a Nazi spy. She's like, I hated him then.
Right.
She's like, but how dare you tell people that I was poor? And
yeah, my that's daddy the one didn't thing.
Sing cocoa to me.
Say everything. Say that I'm a cocoa head. Say that I'm a morphine user and that I hate the Jewish. But don't tell people I was born poor.
There you go.
Well, Chanel's friend and biographer, Marcel Heydrich, has said that Chanel's interactions with the Nazi regime, there you go. This is his quote. If one took seriously the few disclosures that Mademoiselle Chanel allowed herself to make about these black years of the occupation, one's teeth would be set on edge. So basically the few things she actually did, like, state, like, this is my involvement, the few things she did state were so horrible that you would be like, ugh. So it makes you wonder how deep was she involved? Like, we know, like, an overview of her involvement and spying and carrying messages, but, like, how deep was her actual involvement that even her friend would say, like, you know, like, no, like, she was in there. She was deep in there. In 1954, so 15 years after she had closed her shops, she decided to re-enter the fashion world.
My God, how long has she lived up to this
point? Okay, she was born, when was she born? She was born 1983. Who's good at math? 1983 to 1954.
1880. She was like in her 70s.
So already. 83, 93, 3, 13, 23, 33, 43.
She's a 53. She has a bachelor's, you guys. She went to
UNF. She's in her 70s. She's 71.
33, 43.
This is me doing math because I don't have Ariana here to do it for me.
That's how I am with my son. Why am I already exhausted? Like, when is she dying?
Right, dude, her life was so long. I was like, oh my God. Ugh, the evil. I didn't realize what I was, like, getting myself into when I started, like, researching her. So, 1954. She's 71 years at this point. Jeez. And a daily morphine user. Ugh. I just want to make that point. So, 15 years after she closes her shops, she decides to re-enter the fashion world. And she was fully financed by Pierre Werdermeer. So remember, the same Jewish man who she claimed screwed her over actually helped finance her coming back into the fashion world. When she makes her comeback collection, the French press were, like, very cautious of supporting her because they were, like, aware of her Nazi collaborations. But the American and the British press were like, it's a breakthrough. She's back. It's a breath of fresh air. Oh, my God, the elegance, blah, blah, blah. So she ends up making, like, a huge comeback. And during her later years in life, Chanel became very tyrannical and extremely lonely. Like, she, like, really isolated herself. On Saturday, the 9th of January of 1971, Chanel did her usual daily routine of preparing the spring catalog. She went for a drive and then decided to go to bed early because she wasn't feeling well. Her final words were, you see, this is how you die. She died on Sunday, the 10th of January of 1971 at the Hotel Ritz, where she had resided for more than 30 years. She went to her grave as Gabrielle Chasnel because to legally correct her name on her birth certificate would mean she would have to reveal that she had been born in a poorhouse. And that is the story of Mademoiselle Coco Chanel.
That finally died. Dude, she almost lived to be 100.
She did. 1971, 19. She did.
Yeah.
She was almost in her 90s.
My God, lady. Just fucking cool.
That is a long life for a
Nazi. Why do racists, yeah, and Nazis, like, get to live that long? When we've had, like, amazing stories of women that just die at 50, tragically. So here's a lesson, I guess. Don't be if you want to live very long, don't be a good person. Be a shitty person.
Yeah.
But lucky for me, I'm ready to go anytime the Lord wants to take me.
I think we talked about this last night. Carmen's like, I'm ready. And I was like, oh, no, not me. I have to live at least till I'm 100.
The only thing that keeps me going is, like, I'd be too stressed out. I'd be too stressed out to die right now. I'd be like, okay, well, what about the bills? What about the kid? What about, oh my God, I had, like, coffee with somebody in 2 weeks. Like, I'd be already stressed out dying. Like, the idea of dying does stress me out because there's so many to-dos. Shit, did I hit my deadline? Oh my God, did I cancel that? Like, those are the things that I think of. I'm like, yeah, I can't die right now, but I'm ready. Like, I'd be okay.
I'm not. Like, I want to travel and see the world. I am going to travel and see the world, which is why I need 100 years to live so I can properly travel to places and learn the languages and learn the cultures and appreciate it and see the art and see the history. And there's so much in this world that I have to see. I'm not ready.
I'm okay. I can skip through all of that.
I'm also not ready for you because I can't host this by myself, so don't die, Carmen.
See, I'd be stressed about that. So Laura is probably cussing me out right now that I didn't make it to recording.
Yes, I will bring you back from the dead. I'll be like, I don't know how we're doing this, but you are helping me record.
See, it's too stressful. I'm already stressed about dying.
Maybe we should rethink that whole morphine use. I don't know. Just saying.
We don't condone drug use in this podcast.
No, please. Don't be a Coco head.
Don't be a Coco Chanel. All right. Let's see. So I have a story for you, and it's literally breaking news. So, really? Yeah. So I'm going to... Yeah, I guess I'll just go into it. I'm going to tell you...
Wait, the way you say that is, like, making me, like, worry. Like, is this going, like, in a negative light?
It's going to be negative. We're getting...
Oh, so brace myself.
No, I don't think it's negative. I think it's interesting. I think it's a good story. But it does... I will be talking about child abduction. I will be talking about murder. I will be talking... We're going back to the old days, you dirty people.
Content warning.
Yeah, content warning. These stories may not be suitable for kids. Please don't listen with your kids. That'd be wrong, I would think.
Yeah. We are not responsible for people who decide to listen to this podcast with their children. That is your responsibility.
Yeah. I did get most of my information from an article on the New York Times. I've seen reports on CNN and... yeah, let's get into it. So on July 31st of 1960, the remains of a female child were found. The remains were partially buried and burned in the San Wash Creek bed of Old Alamo Road in Congress, Arizona, which is in the Yavapai County. So the autopsy, when they find the little girl, was determined that she was white. Most likely between 5 and 7 years old. She stood about 3 feet 6 inches to 4 feet 5 inches in height. And she likely weighed around 50 to 60 pounds. When they find the body, it seemed as though that body had been there for either 1 or 2 weeks. So, yeah. Her hair color was brown, but it could have been dyed. It was just really hard to tell because the body was burned, right? So, and it was already in state of decomposition. ¿Cómo se dice?
Yeah. Like it was always in a state of decomposition.
Decomposition. What a funny word. they did find that she had a full set of her teeth, her milk teeth, and they were in good condition. So they were able to have those. But other than that.
And this was in 1931.
1960.
Oh, 1960. I'm in the 1930s. I'm sorry.
Pre-1960. So when you think about like the I think between the 60s and the 80s, mm-hmm. I feel like that's the beginning of like abductions galore. And that's when, you know, when people talk about, oh, the good old times and my times, we got to play in the streets.
Yep.
And we were, And it's just like, yeah, bro. But also like in the good old times, people were like, kids were being abducted at a ridiculous rate. So now. Fairly good times. I don't think so.
Yeah, no, that's like where a lot of the horror stories come from. It's like the 70s and 80s. Isn't that like when what's his name was also like super active? That the killer, the really famous one.
We got Bundy, Gacy.
Yes, there you go, Bundy. All of these like active serial killers during that time. I'm pretty sure there's active serial killers right now that we like probably don't know about.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. But yeah, I think like that was their golden era. To me, that was the golden era.
So you mentioned that her teeth, she had her milk teeth, which means that she had not, like, lost any of her kid teeth, her baby teeth, and they were in good condition. So to me, that says that she was at least middle class to upper middle class because of the fact that she had her teeth well taken care of.
Ooh, you're piecing the story together.
Detective Loud on the case.
Puzzle me now. All right, so the death, it was medical examiners weren't able to kind of see what caused her death, but they were very sure that this had been a homicide, right?
So she was dead before she got burnt.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, well, yeah, they burned her body.
Yeah. So. Because like, you know how like they'll look at the lungs to see if you inhaled like some of the smoke. And really? That lets them know, like, if they find smoke inside your lungs, like, it lets them know whether it was, like, a burn before you died or after.
No way.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I don't know. But also, like, this is the 1960s, right? So, like, what resources... We don't
no
have
DNA. The same,
yeah, we don't have the resources that we have today, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And because, again, the body was in bad state, just even drawing a picture of what this little girl looked like was impossible for examiners.
So you said she was partially buried.
Partially buried. So it could have been that they did. Hold on. Edit that out. It could have been that they buried her, and then with animals and vultures and, you know, they were, like, undigging her, so she had been partially.
Okay.
So I don't think it was purposefully done. I think it was the intention was to bury her completely, but she had been exposed.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I think this is really interesting because I think this is a moment when the community gets together and local media in the Yavapai County started leveraging private citizens and just, like, the community got together. We're like, we need to find this little girl. Like, nothing in this world moves people more like light-skinned little baby girls. Like, no, anything but that. So they worked tirelessly in efforts to find out who this little girl is. They threw out this thing called All Points Bulletin. And they use this method in order to send rapid messages via the radio, television, newspapers, so everybody can, like, be aware. And they wanted to broadcast that they had found a little, you know, there's a missing child that was discovered, and so somebody identify her. They even traveled, like, hundreds of miles within the radius to see, hey, who's missing a little girl. They would go into, like, also prisons and talk to people that were already, like, convicted of, like, child crimes and be like, do you know who this was? And everybody would be like, no, bro, I have no idea. So all of this just kind of put a hard stop on the case. And, nobody was claiming this little girl. Have you ever heard about the case about the little boy? There's also a little boy that had the similar situation that nobody ever claimed his body, and they had the same efforts, probably to a bigger scale, and nobody ever claimed the little boy, and to this day we don't know. It's a complete mystery.
No, but I have heard that there's, like, I think it's Louisiana, I want to say. Where does the Mississippi River run through? Louisiana?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's this thing in Louisiana where they have found the bodies of toddlers, like kids who are, like, anywhere between, like, maybe 2 to 3 or 2 to 4. And they, because of the decomposition, they usually can't tell. Like, they also run as cold cases.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever reported them missing. No family's ever come
That's
forward.
Tragic.
Yeah. A lot of people, there's, like, a theory that the parents themselves have gotten rid of the kid this way.
Mm.
And it could have been something where, like, the person didn't really keep in touch with family. So, like, nobody really knew that they were pregnant or they had the kid or stuff like that. But it's really sad how a lot of kids' cases, like, end up going cold because, yeah, like, nobody ever came forward to, like, report them missing or...
Yeah, especially in this time.
Yeah.
And due to all of this, and even though they put in all these efforts, they ended up giving her the name of Little Miss Nobody. So in mid-August, so they found her in July. So by mid-August in 1960, the child was given a funeral using funds raised by residents of Prescott. And then during the ceremony, Dave Paladin, who was a local radio host, and his wife, they actually stood in as her parents at the burial. And they said, somewhere someone is watching to learn what happened to a little girl left on the desert. And Charles Franklin Parker, who was the minister, he told 70 people that were gathered that morning the child that nobody knew. There were 70 people. So, just everybody was like, I don't know, that's so sad. But they kept her their memory alive. They did a whole, like, a cemetery. They had her, like, they gave their respects to her, right? They buried her with a lot of respect, and it was just, you know, it's I think it was a beautiful demonstration of how, like, the community, you know, gathers for something. All right, so now like, they never really had, they had ideas of who this child can be. They even looked at, like, reports of, like, missing children around the area. But they never, it was just that they would get, like, kind of sidetracked. They'd be like, no, it can't be this one. The kid is too old. The kid is too young. The kid just doesn't fit the description. So now we're going to travel from Arizona to a town called Alamogordo, New Mexico, which is 562 miles away from where Little Miss Nobody was found. Do you know Alamogordo?
Yes. Yes, I do. Here in New Mexico.
I didn't know. I don't know why I thought Alamogordo was like in the north of New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Apparently it's like over there by El Paso. Like, right? Like it's in the
Isn't
south.
Isn't it southwest?
Yeah, like, southeast.
I'm pretty sure it is.
I think it's closer to Texas. Closer to the border of Texas.
Let me bring out the hand, like the good old handy dandy maps.
Map time, back.
I'm like Dora the Explorer. Alamogordo.
Yeah, it's like by... I want to say it's like east.
No, it's actually smack in the middle.
Yeah, it's like in the... Yeah, but it's closer to Texas than it is to the other border.
Right? Okay. If you're going based off the highway,
it's east,
yes.
Off of 25. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and in this town in Alamogordo, there was a little girl named Sharon Gallegos. And Sharon was born in September of 1955. She comes from a very traditional Hispanic household, and she has her siblings, right? Her mom, her dad. Her mom, they weren't very, you know, rich or ritzy or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But they always had beans and tortillas and very traditional New Mexican. Like, they describe Sharon as being really feisty, happy-go-lucky, really positive. Like, she was, like, the glue to the family. And what really stood out is that she was also really independent and she took pride into helping the family. So in small towns, there used to be a thing where you could get, like, a corner store, a corner market store, like a tiendita, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Sharon would always be like, Mom, do we need to go buy this? I'll go to buy the eggs and I'll go do this. So her mom would be like, okay. So she would take pride into helping out the family. And she liked to play outside with her cousins, with her siblings. And she was just a regular kid living a regular life. Things changed quickly. During July, they started to spot a green vehicle around the neighborhood. Now, Alamogordo is, even today, it's a very small town. But in 1960, it was even smaller. And so you would be able to tell if there's somebody who's not local. And so this green car started being spotted. And it was like a dark green car. So it just stood out very much. And they started noticing that in the car, there was two people. And they're very light-skinned, freckled face. It was, the woman was a heavier set. The guy was slender. The community started noticing because they started attending like church events. And when they would go to the church, they would start asking like members of the community, like, hey, this little girl, who is she? And, oh, that's little Sharon. Oh, yeah. Does she have a mom? Yeah, she's right there. Like, oh, okay. They would ask so many people at church that they started like finding out where Sharon lived. So they were like literally stalking. They found out where she lived in the area. And the couple went to a neighbor's house and just knocked on the door. And he's like, hey, that little girl, is she like from around here? Yeah, she has a mom. She has her dad, her siblings. She's like, I wanted to ask because like I see her playing out in the streets a lot and I'm just like a concerned citizen. Do the parents, what's the financial situation of the parents? And they're like, what? And then she would continue to like, I want to offer her a job if she doesn't have one to take care of the kids. It's just, I noticed that she has too many kids.
Era plan con maña.
Yeah, like she was like super obsessed with this little girl.
It was very brave of them to
very
be like,
brave to just show their face.
Is your like, mom poor?
Is your mom, is your mom poor? And so the neighbors were just like, yeah, no, like they're fine. Everything is fine. She was like, okay. Little Sharon during this time started change, like her behavior started changing. So when she stopped like being proactive of doing mandados or running errands for the family, like her mom would be like, can you go get some eggs? And she'd be like, no. Why? Because there's a main lady. okay, like, and she just, like, changed.
So the ladies, like, started approaching Sharon.
We don't know. This is all alleged. Like, they only can tell, like, the behaviors that changed.
Okay.
So, like, they would even, when they go walk to the store together, or they'd be walking on the street. Mm-hmm. And if Sharon saw a green vehicle, Sharon would start crying and throwing, like, a tantrum and just asking somebody to pick her up, because she would just get too, like, anxious.
What?
About the situation. So to me, it sounds like these people were approaching Sharon.
And not just approaching, because if she's having that type of reaction to where it's like almost like an anxiety attack, that's like...
Isn't that crazy?
That lets me know that they hurt her.
Isn't it? Yeah. And you know what's really funny is, like, the family can only observe behaviors, but nobody...
Nobody's seen anything. Nobody's seen anything. Heard anything. Yeah,
exactly. And again, the 1960s, it's a time of, like, the kids played outside, you mm-hmm. know, the kids did this, they were very independent, there's no bad people, right? It's like, yes, there are, ma'am. I don't let my son play on the streets by himself, like, now, but that's, like, the different, you know, the different mentality from then. So, on July 19th, Sharon was playing outside with her cousins. And she, you know, she was with her two cousins. They were 5 and 11. And they were playing in an alley really close to their home. The couple approached the kids and asked Sharon if she wanted candy. And Sharon started screaming and said no. And so the couple grabbed Sharon and dragged her and threw her inside the car. Now, the kids around there ran as fast as they could to the mom. Mm-hmm. And the mom, obviously, as you can imagine, became frantic, hysterical, but she ran, and within hours, she's already filing reports. The police already know what's happening, and they do the best they can. So they ended up setting up roadblocks at the border of Texas and New Mexico. And they were stopping every single vehicle that matched the description. They were looking for this couple. And they did this for hours and hours and days. And if they kind of got an idea of, like, you know, through eyewitnesses that this was the couple, they would stop this vehicle. So there was a lot of effort to stop. But they were looking in the wrong direction. They were so focused that it was Texas, New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And they just failed to recover Sharon. So Sharon was on the register for missing and abducted children, right? Mm-hmm. And when Little Miss Nobody gets found, they say, oh, okay, well, it could be Sharon, Little Miss Nobody, because Little Miss Nobody was discovered 2 weeks after the disappearance of Sharon. Mm-hmm. But when they looked at the description, they say no, because Little Miss Nobody is older. And she doesn't fit the, Sharon was, I guess, when Sharon went missing, she had very distinct clothes, but it had been 10 days that she spent with her abductors. So
they could have bought clothes.
But they were just so stuck, like, no, she was wearing these garments. She was wearing this and this and that. But they just never kind of said it could be one and one. It was just the state of the body was just so decomposed and everything.
Yeah.
I think after the Golden State Killer, people mm-hmm. became very, like, interested in what the advances of DNA has done, especially specifically genetical DNA. Mm-hmm. Because what that does is genetical DNA is, it doesn't just match. I mean, the database is so big, but it just doesn't match people. It matches relationships. It matches family trees. So you could potentially find a fourth cousin of such and such and make a connection and discover the identity of certain people. And so the way it's been used in the past was, well, in the last couple of years, it's to talk about serial killers. The Golden State Killer is a great example. They were able to identify who killed all these women, right? And who terrorized Northern California. But in this case, it was used, okay, because there was a lot of debates. Should we be using this testing in court systems? Because it's a privacy concern, mm-hmm. right? So it became very taboo to start using it, or they're trying to figure out a way to use it where it can stand up legal trial. Now, can we use it to identify missing people?
Yeah.
And so what they said in 2018, the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children offered to pay to exhumate the, to do the, I can't say that word, to like unbury. I don't know why I try to use big words. To unbury the body of Little Miss Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And grab enough DNA to test it out and to put it in the archive and to see what comes up. And not just that, because of the DNA, they can get features and reconstruct what this little girl may have looked like.
Oh, like the phenotype.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
So, and so that was their whole intent. So the DNA was extracted from the body successfully, and it was entered in the database of the National Missing and Unidentified Persons and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to get a report back. On March 15th, which was like 2-3 days ago, it was released in the press that they were able to identify that Little Miss Nobody was Sharon Gallegos. And a press conference was just held a couple of days ago where her uncle attended this press conference and spoke in behalf of the family and thanked like the community of in Yavapai County for taking care of her, for giving her a name again. And now people can stop calling her Little Miss Nobody and calling her by her name of Sharon Gallegos.
Oh my God.
And it's brought so much peace and it's beautiful. And I think that's
the closure. Like,
it's like closure.
Decades later, but they got that closure.
They got the closure. So now we're just waiting basically on who did this. Mm-hmm. Was it these people?
It definitely was.
Hmm?
It definitely was them.
It sounds like it was. It sounds like they had been terrorizing her before.
And it was very planned. They were like very meticulous with it, like asking the neighbors, asking like these people were brave.
Yeah.
Like they, the fact that they were so brave, the fact that they were so outright with asking like people from church and the neighbors, it kind of makes me feel like this wasn't their first rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of makes me feel like they're probably responsible for other child abductions around the U.S.
Absolutely. I think that one's going to be harder to figure out who did this and why, and have they done it before, because I mean
they're probably already like passed away or something.
Exactly. I mean, 1960 little,
and they were already like adults back then.
Sharon would be what,
64? She was born what year was
55?
She 55? She's 55.
70?
Where are kids to do math for us?
70, she'll be 70 in a couple of years, so mm-hmm. like 68 or some 67.
Yeah, and if they were already adults, they are either like extremely elderly people, like maybe in their 90s.
You could potentially still be alive.
Well, yeah.
But
I mean, look at, you know, Coco Chanel, who lived to
the
be like
never died.
Ancient. But it's like, okay, it's like, it wasn't that like one of the things about the Golden State Killer is like, he's so old now that people are like, well, why are you going to put an old man in jail? We're like, well, his victims deserve it. Like, they still deserve to get that justice.
But how do you get, how would you connect? How would you discover those people? And I think that's where the case is
There's like no trace of them on her body.
I mean, they were barely able to get DNA from her little body.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any kind of way to track that. And that's the hard part.
Yeah.
Can there be justice? There's closure.
There's closure.
Mm-hmm. Will there be justice?
Oh, that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard. Like, ugh.
But
I can't even imagine myself finding myself in the shoes of Sharon's mom. Like,
the unknownness.
Oh, my God.
For so many years.
It would drive me insane.
Within an hour.
Is her mom still alive?
I don't think. No, because the only person that attended the press conference was her uncle. He's the one that like attended it, but other than that, no. I don't think so. And that imagine.
Yeah, because like, her mom probably would be like elderly.
Within
as
an
well.
Hour, she reported some of the things that I was reading. People were like, because I read the comments because I'm a nerd, and some people are like, why wasn't she reported missing right away? Like, no, she was. And it seems like everybody did their own efforts. They were just not considering that this was the. They were so focused Texas, New Mexico. It would have been a game changer if we would have done the same thing with Arizona,
New Mexico. For like all of the exits. Mexico, Texas, Arizona, Colorado.
But then messages just don't fly that fast, right?
That's
in the
true.
1960s.
Well, yeah, back then they didn't have the technology we have now, like now where I we can like text. Boom, ping people and let know like a child abduction happened so and so. Like I get those all the times, like child abducted in Dallas, child abducted in Houston. And I mean, I'm like, you know, 8-10 hours away in El Paso, but like you said, like we have to be looking at every single exit from
exactly the and state. I think that's the importance, and that's the story you covered during our live, was the Amber Alerts and how it revolutionized
the
way we react to our children. It would have been different if Sharon would have been missing today rather than, you know, whatever, 670
yeah
years? I don't know how 60 years. We can't math.
Oh, we can't do math. We can't pronounce French names or cities or Russian or German.
We can barely speak English.
Yeah.
Thank you for
joining. What can we do?
We can
drink.
We can fight.
We can drink like sailors.
And we can fight like sailors.
We can cuss like sailors.
We can act like sailors.
You know, had we been born boys, we would have made our moms so proud.
Exactly. But because we're women, I don't think we're good enough. Wait, that's me. Sorry. Childhood trauma. Okay, coolness. Well, you guys, this was so much fun. And this was fun just doing it in person.
Yeah. Coming to you from Edai's room.
With dinosaurs and Pokemon.
And using a little table.
A little baby table.
Oh my God. Yes, but our second in-person recording, finally. Is this going to be our 20th episode?
Are we 20 years old?
We are 20. And next episode, we'll finally be drinking age.
Aww.
After getting wasted for like the last 20 of them. 20. Except for like a couple that we didn't.
We did it, you guys. Thank you for joining the journey. And we'll see you next time. And remember, no es cafecito con tu abuela.
It's tequila shots with your best friend.
Goodbye.
Bye.